Okay, thanks. Thank you, Paul. I hope by the end of the talk you really do understand the material instead of simply believing that you understand the material. Although it certainly is a skill to be able to convince people that they understand something that they don't understand. I hope I don't have that skill. Okay. So this is actually a fascinating subject. How machines learn without being taught. Can anything learn without being taught? And the answer is, of course. Humans learn all kinds of things without being taught. I put you in a room, and there's an exit that's hidden, and it's your job to find it. You will eventually find it. You will figure out where the exit is. If I give you tools that you've never seen before, you will look at them, you will play with them, you will do things, and you will figure out somehow what they do and how you can use them. So we know that organisms can learn things without being taught. And I hope it doesn't offend you that I consider humans to be a form of computer. Computers can do anything ultimately that humans can do, I believe. And it's just taking a long time for people to make that happen. And I want to talk a little bit about it. So what I usually do before a talk is I try to delay making the slides as long as possible to make sure that I can get all the latest stuff into the program. And I put everything in the can yesterday. And then I wake up this morning, and I go to Google News, and I see my own hometown newspaper, the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Carnegie Mellon University is in Pittsburgh. This was published yesterday in the United States, and I got it today. As the artificial intelligence race heats up, China is taking action to move toward its goal of rapidly surpassing America. I think they may achieve that goal. And the reason they're going to achieve that goal is that 90% of our students in artificial intelligence at CMU are from China. And so we are training the competition. When a Google computer program beat the world's best player of an ancient Chinese board game last May, it might have seemed like an incremental milestone. But for some, the success of the program known as AlphaGo, and I'll show you examples of it later in the talk, marked more than a man versus machine clash. It set up a broader race between China and the U.S. over artificial intelligence, a competition that could mold the future of humankind just as the widespread arrival of electricity did in the last century. That's quite a comparison, comparing electricity to artificial intelligence. I think, however, it's actually apt. The stakes are high. Advances in artificial intelligence could add trillions of dollars to a major economy and give an edge on the battlefield, shifting empires, and global power. I think all of that's true. So here's an interesting statement that was made by Stuart Walsh, who's an author and consultant. The computer is incredibly fast, accurate, and stupid. Man is unbelievably slow, inaccurate, and brilliant. The marriage of the two is a challenge and opportunity beyond imagination. I think what's happening is there's not that much change going on in man, but there's a tremendous amount of change going on in computer. And there's going to be a time when you won't be able to say that. So my background, just to justify why I'm here, I do have a PhD in computer science, and I think the reason that my thesis is more understandable than my supervisor's book is I wrote my thesis and I didn't write his book. Then I took some time, actually while I was teaching at Carnegie Mellon, to go off and get a law degree. So I became an intellectual property lawyer, practiced intellectual property law for about 8 years. But I've been on the CMU computer science faculty since 1975, so it's more than 40 years. And CMU is one of the places where artificial intelligence developed. I was not a researcher in artificial intelligence, but my colleagues were. And so I watched it happen. And I watched a change in what they thought was artificial intelligence, which nobody would consider artificial intelligence today. If you could write a computer program that could beat a human at checkers, then that was artificial intelligence, because supposedly only human beings can play checkers. And if you can write a program that can beat grandmasters at chess, that must be an intelligent program, because it takes a massive amount of intelligence to beat grandmasters at chess, because only a very few people in the world can do that. The problem was that those programs were not learning programs. What happened was that there was a tremendous amount of study of the structure of those games. The structure was built into computer programs, and the advantage the computer program had was it was running on computers that were getting faster and faster and faster, and had more and more memory and could basically evolve the state space of the game and look ahead farther than a human could do. But that was mechanical in nature. It wasn't intelligence. The programs were not learning. Now, if you say to somebody, I have an intelligent program, they will laugh if that program doesn't learn, because learning is what we think of as intelligence now. I've been for a long time the director of the master's program in e-business technology, which is roughly equivalent to HKU Ecom iComp. One of my former students is actually in the audience today. This program is being phased out, and a new program is being developed that I'm the incoming director of. I'll become the director this August. It's the MS in Artificial Intelligence and Entrepreneurship. Of the 25 master's programs that we have in computer science at CMU, this is the only one that has artificial intelligence in its title, and I think there's a lot of jealousy going on at CMU over that. It won't last very long. Okay, so one of my colleagues, Professor Tom Mitchell, who was the outgoing head of the machine learning department, said, and this is a famous quote of his that you'll see in many artificial intelligence textbook, a computer program learns from experience if its performance on a task improves based on that experience. And so the problem with those checkers programs and the chess programs I told you about is they never improved. They played well, but if you could play better than they did, they would not take advantage of that and turn that around and beat you. The only way that they could be improved was to have the humans who created them tinker with the code and make them better. They didn't learn. And so we're going to talk about machine learning. Now, you have to understand, at CMU, we have an entire department of machine learning. It has so many faculty members that it's probably larger than most computer science departments at other universities. And that's only one of seven divisions that we have in the university. So there's a whole degree program in it. There's a four-semester sequence of courses in machine learning. All of those courses are full-semester courses. And what I'm proposing to do tonight is to acquaint you with the content of a full-semester course in less than an hour. And not only make you believe that you understand it, but actually have you understand it. Okay, that's the objective, and you'll evaluate me based on whether I achieve it. So here are some machine learning examples. These are self-driving cars. They really exist. In my neighborhood in Pittsburgh, there are 20 Uber self-driving cars. I see them every day. Sometimes I see two or three of them in a row. I'm fascinated by them. Yes, there is a human person in the driver's seat, but he doesn't touch the steering wheel or the brakes unless there's some utter emergency. And I haven't actually heard of any such emergencies in Pittsburgh. And the self-driving car problem is incredibly complicated. And the only way it's been made possible is through a technology known as deep learning, which we're going to talk about tonight. Netflix believes that its recommendation system is what keeps people coming back to Netflix. Netflix knows what you're watching, it knows what other people are watching, and it's able to make recommendations to you of programs that you are likely to enjoy. If it made bad recommendations and you wasted your time with those movies, then you would quickly go to some other service other than Netflix. Spam filtering. We all know how inconvenient spam is. There are all kinds of ways of determining what spam is. One of the best ways is for you to mark an email as junk, and then the spam filter learns what you consider junk and what you don't consider junk, and eventually starts filtering out the junk. So it follows Tom Mitchell's definition of learning because its performance improves with experience. Text recognition. Oh, for many, many years, the United States Postal Service has done character recognition on envelopes, particularly on zip codes. Now the idea is, can we recognize cursive handwriting? That's a very difficult problem for humans to do. Sometimes I can't even recognize my own handwriting on documents that I wrote 15 years ago. My handwriting has changed, so I'll have to use an AI program to figure out what I wrote. In biology, for example, the use of machine learning in the studies of genetics. So I'm in the Language Technologies Institute. It's one of the departments I'm in at CMU. And we take a broad view of what language is, and DNA is the language of nature, and so a lot of our researchers are spending time analyzing DNA sequences to figure out what the puzzle there is that nature has in store for us. Okay, so there are four types of machine learning. We're going to go through all four. The first one is easy. That's the no-learning machine learning. And when you have a static computer program, it always performs the same way, so it cannot learn from experience. The changes to the program are made by humans. And so those chess and checker programs that I told you about fall into the category of no learning. They were believed to be intelligent because we had the wrong view of what intelligence was at that time. So you can cross those off. We're going to talk about supervised learning, unsupervised learning, and reinforcement learning. They all three are different from one another. In supervised learning, the program is given examples of inputs and desired outputs, and it changes itself so that its performance improves. The reason it's called supervised is you have to give it examples of inputs and what you think the output or what you desire the output to be. Now, if you don't have such examples, then you have unsupervised learning. This is a very difficult thing to get your head around, as to how can a computer program learn anything without even being guided about what it's learning. And so in unsupervised learning, the program is only given inputs and has to discover patterns in those inputs and tell you about the patterns in them. We'll give some examples of that. In reinforcement learning, also, the program is only given inputs, but it gets rewards for good outputs. And the reward is, for example, in the form of a score. So if it does a computation and a score is computed for it, then what it does is it tries to change things so the score improves. And if it can eventually find a path of increasing scores, it gets better and better and better. And I'll give examples of that. Okay. So I promised this was going to be non-technical, so don't be scared about variables and subscripts and things like that. Don't worry about it. This is a model of a computational system. A computational system has a bunch of inputs. So we have x1 through xn are the inputs. Then the system, which in our case is going to be a computer program, has certain variables inside that you don't see. These are variables that are, for example, formulated by the programmer, and they're temporary places in which the partial results of computations are held. And eventually the computer program produces a bunch of outputs. So L outputs y1 through yl. So inputs, these internal variables, and the reason they're called H is that we often refer to them as hidden variables. They're hidden because whoever is operating the program can't see them. He can see the inputs and he can see the outputs, but he can't see what's going on inside. Okay? That's a computational system. Almost every computer program you can imagine looks like that. Okay. Now, let's suppose we would like to predict apartment prices. This is a very famous problem in supervised learning. Some of the inputs we would think are relevant to determining the price of an apartment. There are all kinds of things that may or may not be relevant. For example, the temperature today may or may not be relevant to the price of an apartment. Usually the temperature is relevant. And the reason is if you talk to a real estate agent, they'll tell you there are certain days on which it's much easier to sell real estate than on other days. If the weather is terrible, for example, and the view out the window of the apartment looks awful, then the price that people are willing to pay for that apartment is much lower than if it were a really beautiful day. So you didn't think about that. And so what happens is that you feed huge amounts of data into the program. Now, some of these, I think, are obviously relevant. The area in square meters, how many rooms, how much did the current owner pay for it when he bought it, and how long ago was that? And then what floor is it on? We all know that as you go higher, the apartment prices increase. Okay? And so this system, which has a bunch of hidden variables, is going to predict what the price should be today based on these variables. And initially it might get it way wrong because there's no intelligence in here. It doesn't know anything about how you compute a price of an apartment. Okay? Now the classic non-learning approach, and these programs have existed for a very long time, is that the human constructs a model. The human believes he knows what the contribution of these various variables is going to be to what the price should be, and he writes out possibly a big complicated formula and then programs it in some programming language. And if his model is good, then this thing will perform well. If his model is bad, it's going to perform badly, and it's never going to improve itself. And the only way it can be improved is if the creator of the program looks at the predicted prices and sees that they're off, and he says, oh, there must be something wrong with my model. I better go change it and change some code. Okay? So that's the classic non-learning approach. If the model is inaccurate, we need a new model. And, of course, you need a new computer program to implement the model. Not so good. Okay. Now, how can we learn to predict apartment prices? Here are the same variables. There's the same output. However, what I'm going to do is train it. I'm going to give it what the variables are for a particular apartment, and I'm going to give it a known price for what that apartment sold for. And then I'm going to see what the system produces, what the predicted price is. And if I use a large number of price examples, it might be possible for this program to modify itself to get better and better. And in fact, that's what happens. We look at the predicted price, PI, for the ith apartment, and we compare that with the actual price that the apartment sold for, and there's an error there. If there's no error, you're done, okay? But there's always going to be an error. And if we use the error to go and modify the program, then eventually, if we modify it correctly, then the program is going to get better and better and better. And eventually, it may surpass even the most skilled real estate agent in figuring out what the price could be, because the number of variables that can go into this is huge. There are small differences in location. Whether you're on this side of the street or that side of the street may have cause a tremendous difference in the price. Okay? And so that's supervised learning. Now I'm going to show you how supervised learning happens. And one of the important methods is something called neural networks. Neural networks were originally developed actually in the 1950s, as an effort to see if we could model how the human brain might work. We didn't know how the brain worked, but we had some ideas. And you shouldn't believe that this in any way actually represents how the human brain works. And nobody in artificial intelligence pretends that. But there are certain aspects of neural networks that really seem to be similar to the way our brain works. So here's what a neuron is. A neuron is a small computational element. A neural network has lots and lots and lots of these things. And what it does is very simple. It has a number of inputs, and these correspond to the x1 through xn that we saw on the previous slide. And these inputs have certain weights. So there's a multiplication of weight I times xi, which is how much weight this input is given versus how much weight that one is given versus how much that one's given. So, for example, the area in square meters of the apartment might have a high weight because it has a lot of effect on the price. Today's temperature might have a nearly zero weight because it may not affect the price very much. So you need to weight these inputs. And what the neuron does, that's what's here, is it computes a function of the sum of the weighted inputs. And that's the output the neuron produces. Y. Okay? Now, these are the inputs. These are the weights. And the neuron computes a function of the sum of the weighted inputs and outputs a value Y. Okay? Now, it's unlikely that a single neuron is going to be able to do apartment price prediction. So, here's the relationship, supposedly, between actual neurons in the brain and neurons in neural networks. You can see here that there's a cell. The cell has a nucleus, and this axon is the output of the cell. These are the inputs. These are receiving inputs from nerves. The output goes through this axon, and then it branches out. So the output goes to multiple places in the brain. And so in a neural network, there can be many inputs. The neuron does its thing, and then there's a branching out of the outputs that can go to other neurons, which are going to make different uses of the values that come out. So there's some, at least, architectural relationship between the brain and neural networks. So here's a neural network. The inputs come in here at the input nodes. You can see that every input node is connected to every node in the next layer of neurons. And these things are called hidden layers because you can't see them. You know what the inputs are, and you can see what the outputs are, but you can't see what's going on in here. That's why they're called hidden. And you can have multiple hidden layers. Many neural networks only have a single hidden layer. You can have many hidden layers, and you can see there's also full connectivity here. Each one of these is sending its output to every one of these other ones. And they're weighted, just like these are weighted. There's a weight on every edge here. And then there are the output neurons, which perform the last computation. They take all the inputs from all of the nodes in the last hidden layer, and they do their calculation, and they produce an output. Now, if you're only looking for one number, like the predicted price of a house, you would only have one output neuron. But very often you want multiple outputs. And so this is a very general structure. Okay. Now, this looks exactly like this. There are inputs x1 through xn, there are outputs y1 through yl, and there are a bunch of hidden things going on in there, and these are the neurons at the hidden layer. So it follows the prescription that I gave earlier. Now, here's a neural network for price estimation of houses. Here, it takes three inputs. How many bedrooms, how many square feet, and what neighborhood is it in? Because there are certain neighborhoods that command high prices and certain neighborhoods that don't. And then what happens is these weights are all different, and a bunch of temporary values are essentially computed. They're like temporary variables in a computer program, except their value happens to be what the output is of that particular neuron. And all of these go into the final neuron, which does the outputting of the estimated price. I'm not suggesting that this would work well. This is just an example of what a neural network might look like for predicting house prices. So, now I want to show you that neural networks can learn. And here's a learning algorithm, real simple. Given an input and a known desired output, this is supervised learning, run the neural network to see the actual output, and the error is the desired output minus the actual output, and now this is the key step right here, this bullet point. Use the error to modify the weights in the neural network. So if you find out that the temperature today is contributing too much to the value of the price of the apartment, you reduce the weight of that. And eventually, if the price is totally independent of the temperature, the weight will decline to zero, as it should. Okay? And this process is called training the network. It's not teaching the network. Teaching the network would be telling the network what the relationship is between this variable and the price of an apartment. We don't know that. If we knew that, we wouldn't need the neural network. We don't have a perfect model for that. So it's training, which is different from teaching. Okay? You don't tell the neural network how to do something. Okay? So here's how it's going to learn. Here are the input values, input layer, some hidden layers, and an output layer. The error in output 1 is used in the backward direction to adjust the weights on these red edges. The error in output 2 is going to be used to adjust the weights on the green edges. Now, this is going to backpropagate. And the backpropagation involves changing the weights on all of these edges, and then eventually changing the weights on those edges. And then what we're going to do is we're going to keep running the network on the examples, and we're going to keep doing it until it converges, basically doesn't get any better on the training set that we have. Okay? That's learning. And the reason it's learning is nobody's sitting there and telling it what the relationship is between any of these variables and the price. That's determined by the data. We don't know what the relationship is. The data knows what the relationship is. Okay? So, how would you do, for example, image recognition? How could you train a neural network to recognize a picture of a cat? Okay? This is not so easy, because this looks like a cat to you. But what it looks like to a machine is a bunch of RGB pixel values. So every pixel is composed of a red, a green, and a blue component. They range in intensity from 0 to 255. So a triple of numbers from 0 to 255 represents one pixel in that image. So all the machine gets is this huge matrix of numbers. That doesn't look like a cat to me. And so why would it look like a cat to a machine? Okay? So 0, 0, 0 is black, 255, 255, 255 is white. And 255, 98, 89, 255, 98, 89 is a shade of pink. And you can see there's a little pink on the bottom of the cat's paw there. Okay? So this is some actual data. Now, the problem is that if you have a triple of numbers for each pixel, each going from 0 to 255, you get 16 million possible values for each pixel. And if I give you a 1,000 by 1,000 image, which is not a very high resolution image these days, There are 16 trillion possible inputs. And we have to train a neural network to recognize cats. Okay? Out of those 16 trillion possible inputs, some of them are cats and some of them are not cats. And some of them are cats leaping up in the air, and some of them are cats with their tail facing you, and some of the cats don't look like other cats, and sometimes cats look like dogs and vice versa. And so it's not so easy. Okay? I have done the wrong thing. Okay. Here's some examples. You immediately recognize that all of those things are cats. Even the outline drawing, the faint outline drawing, this is obviously a cat. Okay? How do you know that? Because you have a lifetime of experience with cats. You've seen them all over the place, but you've never seen that cat, and you've never seen that one, and you've never seen that. But nonetheless, you know what the characteristics are of a cat. Now, if I want a neural network that's going to recognize a cat, is there some way I could tell it every possible thing it ought to be able to recognize about a cat? I don't even know what those are. Cat lovers probably don't know what they are. Maybe judges in cat shows would be really good at that, but they're probably not computer programmers. So what good is it? All right? Now, in supervised learning, however, what we're going to do is we're going to show a bunch of cats to the computer program. And when I say show, it means we're going to take that 1,000 by 1,000 pixel image and we're going to jam that in. That's a million inputs, right? 1,000 by 1,000 matrix is a million inputs that we're going to feed to the neural network. And we're going to train it by telling it each of these inputs, whether it's a cat. If it's a cat, we're going to desire the output 1. And if it's not a cat, we're going to desire the output minus 1. And then we're going to see what the network does. And if the network gets it wrong, and when it gets it way wrong. Okay? 0.99 is not a valid output. It's either 1 or minus 1. And if it says that this dog is a cat, then that's a huge error. And that error is going to backpropagate through the network, and the weights are going to change. And the next time it sees a dog-like image, it's not going to be so sure that it's a cat. And eventually, it's going to know that it's not a cat. Okay? Now, supervised learning has been used on handwriting recognition. And I actually find this to be quite difficult. I had to stare at this word for a long time before I could even read what it said. It's like they hired somebody whose penmanship was really terrible, which is, I guess you need that to train neural network. It's the word judging, okay? Yeah, I had to stare at it. And fortunately, there's a little clue here, because this is what the neural network said that it meant, said judging. Judging by your completely uninformed opinion, I'm going to go ahead and venture to guess you've never actually used any of these technologies, uses in all caps, for any extended period of time. Okay? It should, if at all. Right? So it got it. Okay, now, the reason I use this example is this is a chore that's difficult for humans. And so how do neural networks get trained to do this? On millions of examples. That's how they get trained. More examples than you could ever see in your lifetime. That's why they can be better than humans. All right. Supervised learning application predicting airline ticket prices. This is a real website. It's called Fareboom. Now, you know that the price of airline seats varies over time until the plane takes off. Once it takes off, I don't think you can buy seats anymore. And this is an airline ticket is known to economists as a wasting asset. Wasting asset is one that has zero value after a given time. And so I ask you, if I'm going to fly a jet plane and half the seats are empty and a passenger shows up 1 minute before they close the door and says, how much will you take for a seat? What do you think they're going to say? Are they going to sell it to you real cheap? No. They won't sell it to you real cheap because this is going to be a repeated game. If this were not a repeated game, they might sell it really cheap. But it's a repeated game. And you're going to tell your friends, you want a cheap seat? Run to the airplane right before it takes off and you'll get a cheap seat. And once people know that, then the airlines are going to start losing money because people won't book far in advance. All right? So prices vary all the time. I actually have to know something about how they do this. And the number of variables that go into this is huge. And one of the variables is, how many people took this flight exactly 1 year ago on the same date? That's one of the variables that goes into it. And so what Fareboom has recognized is that the price of an airline ticket, now this is where the plane's going to take off over here, the price can vary. It can go up and it can go down and it can go up and then go down again. And of course, you want to get it at the minimum price that you can. So let's suppose that on July 30th, you're interested in flying and buying a ticket in September. Well, if you have this information, you're not going to buy the ticket today because it's $527, and they predict it's going to go on down to $500 in 2 weeks. And so you might wait. If you can trust Fairbloom's neural network, you might wait. Okay? Of course, there's a problem, which is that many other people might be using Fairbloom also. And so there might be a rush to buy the tickets on the 14th of July, and the price might go way up, higher than $500. But, you know, those are the breaks. Okay? So this actually exists, and it's a trained neural network. And, of course, it's getting better all the time, because they're getting fare quotes from the airlines for tickets at various times, and they're using that to backpropagate through the neural network. Okay. I think all of that was pretty easy to swallow, right? You can sort of see how, if you give it examples, then it's going to figure out what the common characteristics are of the examples. This one is much more difficult to comprehend. In unsupervised learning, there is no training data. We don't tell the computer whether it was right or wrong about something. It's got to figure it out by itself. The network has to detect similarities or patterns in the inputs without being told what those patterns might look like. Okay? So there's unsupervised learning going on all the time, every day. If you use Google News, it uses unsupervised learning to cluster news stories. Google News would not be useful if the stories were marginally inept, if they weren't clustered together in terms of sports, entertainment, politics, etc., if there were ridiculous amounts of replication where it didn't recognize that these two news stories were really the same thing and categorize them differently, it would not be a useful service. So here's an example of clustering. All of these stories are about India. These stories are about the world, which that's very interesting. Because this says death toll in China quake near 600. You would think that that would be a China story. But that's a story of world interest. On the other hand, HSGMC members clash with police in some place I can't pronounce. That's not a world story. That's of interest to people who are really focused on India, etc. So determining the categories and how do you create that title? That title is actually not one of the titles of any of the news stories. That is a synthetic title that is created by Google to describe all of the stories that fall under that category. Okay, so here's how unsupervised news clustering occurs. There was a Reuters data set that had 804,414 newswire stories that had appeared over Reuters. And a model was created, not filled by the programmers, but created, of a document. What does a news story consist of? It consists of a bag of words. And many of those words are repeated in the story, and some of the words only appear once. And that's how we would determine what category a news story would fall in as to what words are used in the story. But I can't say to it, stories that have China are in the world category. That would be supervised learning, right? We let it figure it out for itself. Now, what it did was these things clustered in these different categories. Of course, the program couldn't name the titles. Right? Somebody had to come along later, look at the stories, and assign a title to them. But these things clearly, very distinctively cluster into different components. Stories that talk about disasters and accidents often involve death, for example, of large numbers of people. Whereas an obituary involves the death of one person. And so you can easily distinguish in general between obituaries and disaster stories, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So now you can start to get a clue as to how unsupervised learning occurs. The program is looking for patterns that you might not have even known were there in the data. Sometimes this is referred to as data mining. Okay? Now, image recognition. Image recognition is one of the toughest problems that there is. Humans are pretty good at it. And, you know, if you only have one thing in the picture, like a horse, it's not actually so tough. But if you have three horses in the picture, and a man's on one, and a woman's on another, and a kid's on another, and one of the people is holding an umbrella, then recognizing the horse, the people, and the umbrella all in the same image is not so easy. because the program would probably never have seen a picture like that before.
Okay.
On the other hand, you can certainly see that pictures of different types in unsupervised learning cluster in certain components that way. And once you see what the clusters are, now what you have is an unsupervised network that knows how to distinguish, for example, marine and aero photos from bird and frog photos, without ever having been told how to do that. Without ever having been told, oh yes, you're right. Good feedback on that. Pats on the back. Doesn't happen. Okay? Now, to show you how some of this is possible, I want to introduce you to a brilliant concept, I think it's brilliant, called an autoencoder. An autoencoder is something that, it's very difficult for me to even express this. I'll explain what it is, and you'll see how monstrous the concept is. So we would like to recognize cats. The problem is that if I train a neural network to recognize that thing, then a slight variation on that thing will not be recognized. And so what I need to do is I need to create a network that's going to figure out what the essence is of a cat. What is the minimal encoding of a cat that applies to all cats? And so if I can take an image and reduce it to a similar encoding and then compare the encodings, I'll be able to tell whether it's a cat or not. And so how can you do this without training a network? The answer is something called an autoencoder. An autoencoder is an encoder that trains itself. And the way you do this is by having multiple inputs, and at some point in the hidden layers, you have a bottleneck layer which has a very small number of neurons. And the small number of neurons means that you can't be recognizing that many features of the cat. You're recognizing an essential cat. What is the essence of the cat? And so what you do is you autoencode, you create a set of neurons here that have an encoding or a representation of cat, and then you basically have a reverse network that goes from that encoding of a cat to an actual cat. Well, how do you know that it's an actual cat? Well, you compare with the input that you just got. And so it encodes itself. It's an autoencoder. It's amazing. It's like it's a box that you sit off in the corner and you go out and have dinner, and when you come back, it's trained itself without any help from the outside world. Autoencoders are used tremendously in image recognition. So here's an example of an autoencoder. So here we have an input, and what the encoder does is it reduces the amount of information in the input, tries to encode it into a smaller number of bits. Then, to see if the encoding was good, we blow it up by decoding it and see what we get, and we compare those two things. Now, you can see they're not identical. This one's fuzzier up here at the top, but that's clearly a 4. No problem there. Now, here's a new trick to get the autoencoder to work better. And the answer is that you add noise to the image. If you add noise to the image, it makes the encoder much more robust, because essentially you're giving it images that you never even fed to it. It's creating its own variation of the image and then seeing if it can create a 4 back again. So here's the 4 input. Here's some additive noise. We have a noisy input, and what happens is it's been successful, and it's produced a clean 4 as output. It figures out how to get rid of the noise, even though it doesn't know what noise was added. Okay? Because the encoder receives this input. It doesn't receive this and that. Otherwise, it would be trivial to subtract the noise. Okay? They're amazing, autoencoders. Now, I promised in the abstract I was going to talk about deep learning. Deep learning is a brilliant phrase. The world changes based on the cleverness of people who give names to things. Deep learning sounds like deep thought. So if you have a difficult problem to solve, you go off in a corner and you focus. And if there's any, you know, any interruption at all, you snap it. Get out of here. I'm busy work. I'm deep thought. Okay? Deep learning is sort of like that, but not at all. Okay? It is deep thought, but not in that sense. All that deep learning means is you're using what's referred to as a deep neural network. A deep neural network has multiple hidden layers. The more hidden layers, the deeper. Okay? Now, why do having lots of layers help? It just seems to complicate everything. The reason is that if the topology of the network is properly constructed, and that's an art and it does require a lot of skill from human beings, what you can do is arrange it so that the features of the image are separately recognized at the different layers. So, for example, let's suppose we want to recognize a dog. First thing that you have to do is recognize the edges of this, whatever this thing is. So these are boundaries between different colors. So you can see that the blue is not part of the dog and the beige is. But here the dark beige and the light beige are both parts of the dog, but there's an edge there. And so those are very different kinds of edges. So if you can create a neural network that recognizes edges, then you can use those edges as features to combinations of edges, which represent subshapes in a picture. And then you can identify the grosser features, for example, like an entire leg. Does this thing have four legs? Well, it looks like it has three, but that's because of perspective, right? There's a hidden leg. I guess the hidden layer has to recognize the hidden leg. And there's a tail, etc. And so if the network is properly trained, it's deep because you have to build up features from one another, then it successfully outputs dog. And we would all agree that that's a dog. Okay? Now, here's an example of how it works. This is a deep neural network because it has multiple hidden layers. Here's an image that it's being given. And these things are edges that have been detected in the image. Now, when you look at that edge, you can't tell much about identifying what the image is. Because there are many images that are going to have edges like that. Okay? On the other hand, as you go to the next layer, these neurons are basically recognizing combinations of edges. Well, that sort of looks like a human eye there, okay? But that doesn't tell me much, and that doesn't tell me much, that doesn't tell me much. But the next layer has learned to recognize faces by putting together combinations of the features in this layer, and now you can start to see that these are all faces, okay? Now, this is another example in which, look at this, all of the edges are identical at the first hidden layer. However, at the second hidden layer, this one has learned to recognize faces. This one has learned to recognize cars. This one, elephants, and this one, chairs. So you can see there are differences here between the features that the second layer recognizes in a face-trained network versus the features that are recognized in a chair-trained network. And then at the third layer, these are all clearly faces. Those are all clearly cars. Those are relatively clearly elephants. And those seem to be chairs, okay? So it succeeds by being deep and by having been trained properly. Okay, now I'm going to give you some real-life examples. Recognizing elephants and dogs and cats doesn't sound like an important problem. Diagnosing skin cancer is an important problem. The reason for that is one skin cancer in particular, malignant melanoma, is essentially always fatal, especially if not caught in time. So Stanford researchers, they are competitors. They're not CMU, but they're a good university. We respect them. Researchers at Stanford collected 130,000 images of skin lesions representing over 2,000 different skin diseases. I had no idea there were that many. They used the data as a training set on a deep neural network using only pixels and disease labels as inputs. So the network was not trained that if you see this particular pigment or this particular shape of a mole, then it's this kind of cancer. No, it was not trained that. It just, here's the picture, and there's the diagnosis. That's all it was given. After training, it performed as well as expert dermatologists and performed better than non-expert dermatologists. The average dermatologist is not as good, okay, as this computer program. The Stanford researchers projected that there are going to be 6.3 billion smartphones by the year 2021. A smartphone can take an image of a skin lesion with sufficient resolution to be input to this program, and so they believe that they're going to be able to provide low-cost, universal access to diagnostic procedures. Now, certainly, you don't necessarily want to trust the output of a computer program with your life. On the other hand, there are parts of the world where these people are never going to get to see a dermatologist in their entire lifetime. And if they can point their cell phone camera at their skin and get at least a tentative diagnosis, then it might be possible to intervene early in ways that would not be possible without technology of this kind. So here's an example of the inputs and the labels. And here is the clustering that the network found. And they cluster fairly well. If you look at, malignant ones are the dark orange and the blue. The dark orange and the blue are up here. And the non-malignant ones are the light yellow and the green. And they're down here. And the network wasn't told that. The network figured that out from the inputs. All right. Here are some other deep learning applications. Uber estimates arrival time. So when you get an Uber car, it tells you when it's going to arrive. How do they know? They don't ask the driver. He probably can't estimate. He doesn't know what traffic is up ahead that he can't see. How do they know that? They've trained a neural network on millions of previous trips. They know exactly the time at which those trips took place. They know something about traffic conditions. They also know in real time about traffic conditions. I can tell you how they do that. And all of that is factored into the arrival time. They know better than the driver does when he's going to arrive. If they weren't accurate about that, then you wouldn't trust Uber. Uber Eats estimates food preparation time to allow prediction of final delivery time. So it's a combination. They know how long it's going to take to cook the food because they have a lot of history, experience with that. They also know what the current traffic conditions are, so how long it's going to take you to get it. So food prep plus delivery time is given to you by Uber Eats. Recommendation engines, Amazon and Netflix. Netflix estimates that the value of its recommendation engine is 20 billion Hong Kong dollars. And they come up with that valuation based on customer retention. If they believe that if they didn't have a good recommender, then customers would start evaporating from Netflix. Google Maps has analyzed 80 billion street view images to recognize house numbers and street signs. They know where the stop signs are. They know what the speed limit is, not because the government tells them, but because the little cars that they have driving through the neighborhood takes pictures of all these things. Did you ever wonder how Google Maps knows? You put in an actual house number, how does it know that that's the house number? You can't buy a map from the government that tells you that. They did it by hunting through the data themselves. And then Facebook deepfakes facial recognition. So let's talk about facial recognition. Interesting. Bunch of faces. There are two kinds of facial recognition. One is facial verification. So, for example, if my cell phone knows the image of my face, all it has to do is recognize mine. And if it's anybody else in the world, it says, no, it's not James. Okay? Relatively easy. Trained neural networks can perform better than humans on that task. They do better than 99.9% accuracy. The other kind of facial recognition is identifying somebody. So here's a picture of a person. Who is that? What's their name? The best recognizers now get that at 80% out of a population of 1 million. Okay? So, The New Scientist. Meet the winners of the biggest ever face recognition challenge. Everyone from government agencies to police forces are looking for software to track us in airports or spot us in CCTV images. I don't want to read the whole article. But they had a prize challenge. The winners of the face verification task was a company called NTech. Okay? Now, the company that won the face recognition prize was a company in Shanghai. And so this dovetails with the story that was in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette about how China surpassing the United States in artificial intelligence. Okay. So I can't explain all this to you because we haven't done enough detail on the neural networks. But this is how Facebook's deep face recognizer works. So this is a picture of actress Calista Flockhart. One of the first things that it has to do is frontalize. So she's off at an angle. And she won't match up with a picture of her that's taken full on. So there has to be a geometric transformation to frontalize the person. Then, of course, this is essentially of the nature of an autoencoder. This is an encoding that's taking place to get down to what are the essential features of her face, regardless of what kind of lipstick she has on or makeup or what her hairstyle is today. Those things don't change the essential nature of your face. Okay? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it goes through, and it's actually astounding in its performance. Now, we'll end by talking about reinforcement learning. Reinforcement learning has proven to be among the most astounding types of machine learning, at least to me. And so what happens in reinforcement learning is you have a neural network, it produces an output, and that output is judged according to some score. And what the network is designed to do is to try to maximize its score. It keeps changing its weights until it can get higher and higher score. And if the score is what you're after, then indeed the network will learn amazing things. So this is for stock picking, for example. And if the stock goes up and you make money, then that's a positive score. It's a plus number. If the stock goes down, that's a negative number, and so it was a bad stock picker. And eventually, if you give it enough data, it will figure out how to predict stocks, assuming they're predictable. If it's a completely random process, then there's no amount of prediction that's ever going to work. But we know it's not completely random, right? Okay. So here's an example, an amazing example. The learning of the game Atari Breakout. In Atari Breakout, there's this ball that shows up, and as it comes down here, you're supposed to get your slider over there to prevent it from dropping through at the bottom. And if the ball hits your slider, it'll bounce up, and when it hits any one of these things, it knocks them out of the game. And so the score is the total number of things you knock out. Okay? Now, here's a video. I'm going to play the first 2 minutes of it from Google DeepMind. I find this amazing.
Dear fellow scholars, this is 2 minutes papers with Carol Zola inside it. This one is going to be huge, certainly one of my favorites. This work is a combination of several techniques that we have talked about earlier. If you don't know some of these terms, it's perfectly okay. You can remedy this by clicking on the pop-ups or checking the description box, but you'll get the idea even watching only this episode.
Yes, you will.
So first, we have a convolutional neural network. This helps processing
deep
understanding what is depicted on an image, and a reinforcement learning algorithm. This helps creating strategies, or to be more exact, it decides what the next action we make should be, what buttons we push on the joystick. So this technique mixes together these two concepts, and we call it deep cue learning, and it is able to learn to play games the same way as a human would. It is not exposed to any additional information in the code, all it sees is the screen and the current score. When it starts learning to play an old game, Atari Breakout, at first, the algorithm loses all of its lives without any signs of intelligent action.
It lost a life there,
If we wait a bit, it becomes better at playing the game.
2 hours later.
The skill level of the adult player. But here's the catch. If we wait for longer, we get something absolutely spectacular. It finds out that the best way to win the game is digging a tunnel through the bricks and hit them from behind. I really didn't know this, and this is an incredible moment. I can use my computer, this box next to me, that is able to create new knowledge, find out new things I haven't known before. This is completely absurd. Science fiction is not the future. It is already here.
Okay, so you see what happened. When it tunneled up to the top, when it got up there, it just kept bouncing up and down, knocking blocks off, and the player didn't have to do anything. It was just killing stuff up there, which is a tremendous strategy for winning the game. Now, what's amazing about that example is that the program was told nothing whatsoever about the rules of Atari. All it knew was it could move this thing back and forth, and it could watch the score. That's all. And of course, it has to have an image of the current state of the game so it can see what the connection is between where the ball is going and what it's doing. And so if you asked it, what's your strategy for winning this game, it wouldn't have any clue. It can't output what it knows, but it just knows it. It's sort of like people who are brilliant but can't explain what they do. I know a lot of those people. They work at CMU. We'll end with this. Reinforcement learning in Go. So in 2017, and I remember when this news story came out, AlphaGo Master, which is a Go-playing program, defeated the world Go champion, Kei Jie. And after it was over, he was interviewed, and he was so in awe of the program, he actually referred to it as God. I guess if you've spent your entire life becoming a Go expert, becoming the best in the world, and this little box comes along and beats you, you probably imagine that God is living in there. Okay? Now, he must feel really bad at this point, because AlphaGo Zero, which sounds like it was an earlier version, but it's actually a later version, AlphaGo Zero can now beat AlphaGo Master. Okay? It's absolutely incredible. There was no knowledge of Go except the rules for legal play. You have to know where you were allowed to put a stone. The reward function was the number of stones remaining at the end of the game. So that's the reinforcement, is get a higher and higher score. How many of your stones remain at the end of the game? AlphaGo Zero played a huge number of games against itself. That's the great thing. With many of these games, you don't need an opponent. Okay? It played against itself to maximize its reward. During its own self-training, it played 1.6 million games per day. The outputs were used to train a neural network. Okay, so the hardware on which it runs costs $25 million. Okay, but that's nothing for the U.S. Department of Defense, for example, if they want to become the best Go player in the world. Okay, so here's its progress. After 3 hours, it played like a human beginner. After 19 hours, it learned fundamentals of Go strategy, like life and death, influence, and territory. After 70 hours, it played at a superhuman level and involved discipline and multiple challenges. Okay? That's just, this thing just repeats over and over again. But here you can see its progress. This is the formerly best program, right? AlphaGo Li, then AlphaGo Master. That's the one that beat the world champion. And this is AlphaGo Zero. And after 3 days, it was able to surpass the first one. And after 21 days, it surpassed AlphaGo Master. And you can see it's still continuing to improve slowly, getting better and better and better. And that's only after 40 days. And so if you run the thing over and over and over again, who knows what's going to happen. So here's a map of what we just did tonight. We did an entire course in machine learning in less than an hour, and we talked about unsupervised learning, in which clustering gets done, looking for patterns in the data. We talked about supervised learning, in which there are training pairs of data, and I showed you examples of reinforcement learning, in which programs learn by themselves simply by trying to maximize a reward function. Okay? And there we are. Machine learning has influenced a tremendous number of industries. The New York Times had an article a few months ago that PhDs in artificial intelligence are commanding salaries of $300,000 to $500,000 US. US, $300,000 to $500,000 initially. Okay? When they get hired right out of getting a PhD, their starting salary is between $300,000 and $500,000. That's why I have a tremendous expectation that my new program in artificial intelligence and entrepreneurship will attract a large number of students, even though it's not a PhD program. Many, many startups exist in machine learning. All you have to do is put the words machine learning in the title of your company, and you will have no problem whatsoever in attracting venture capital. I'm not kidding. Whether you know anything about machine learning or not, sometimes titles are enough. All right. It's been loads of fun to do this. I'll be happy to take questions as long as Paul lets me.